This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Stroke. It's feared, it's deadly, and it's debilitating. As far as statistics are concerned, you're more likely to have a stroke if you live in the South. In fact, stroke is the third leading cause of death in North Carolina. And our state is considered to be the buckle of the stroke belt, which includes several states in the southeast part of the country where stroke rate deaths are significantly higher than the rest of the United States.
We're experiencing strokes at least two times higher than the rest of the country.
Margaret Rodesill is the program director with the North Carolina Stroke Association.
We're not sure why that is. It's been that way for 30 years.
Every 20 minutes in North Carolina, someone is hospitalized with a stroke, and every 2 hours, somebody dies from a stroke. Rodesill says knowing the symptoms and getting help as soon as possible greatly decreases the chance of death and disability. She adds the best way to prevent a stroke is by simple lifestyle changes, such as eating healthy foods and getting plenty of exercise.
We have made strides in blood pressure treatment. If we're not following up with physicians and if we're not going to change our lifestyle, then it's a time bomb. Most people do want a pill to treat everything because that's the easiest thing.
Stroke is claiming less deaths every year, thanks to technological breakthroughs in the scientific and medical communities. Every year, there are 208,000 living survivors of stroke in North Carolina. The number one goal of treating a stroke patient is restoring the blood flow to the brain. Two new devices are being used to help reopen blocked arteries called the Solitaire Flow Restoration Device and the Trevo Device. They both operate similar to a stent that opens up heart arteries. However, the devices are smaller, more flexible, and only temporary.
These devices have really been a great advance for us, allowing us to do these procedures more successfully, more efficiently, faster, and much safer than we were able to do them before.
That's Dr. David Fiorella. He's a professor in neurosurgery and neuroradiology at Stony Brook University Medical Center in Long Island, New York. They've been using both devices for about a year and have performed 50 to 60 successful procedures.
When the patient comes to us with a blocked artery in the brain, we, under X-ray guidance, using very sophisticated X-ray equipment, drive our catheters very delicately across the area of the blockage. We can then put these stent retriever type devices like the Trevo and Solitaire, we thread them through these tiny catheters that are in the brain.
Once the stent retriever device is delivered to the area of the blockage, surgeons pull back its microcatheter as the stent expands into a cylindrical tube.
And basically, as it expands, it pushes the clot material out of the way and immediately restores blood flow to the brain.
Once blood flow is normal, the Trevo or Solitaire device is removed within minutes.
Once we pull that out, it oftentimes typically will pull the clot with it, removing what's left of the clot from the brain artery, leaving an open brain artery.
Dr. Fiorella says the latest figures show a 90% success rate for the procedure. The Trevo or Solitaire flow restoration devices are administered by trained neurosurgeons, so only a handful of medical centers have implemented these devices. Here in eastern North Carolina, Vidant Health in Greenville is using the technology. Neurosurgeon at East Carolina University's Vidant Medical Center, Halal Kanan.
And so from a technical standpoint, the device is very straightforward to deploy. And between me and my partner, Dr. James, we have a 100% success rate in opening up the blood vessels. But that doesn't necessarily mean 100% of patients have done well from the procedure because whether we were able to save brain and time or not was the issue. So our success rate is pretty comparable to national trends of 50 to 70% chance that we will open up the blood vessel and improve neurologic function.
Vidant Health and Onslow Memorial Hospital are the only two hospitals in coastal North Carolina with a dedicated stroke center. Each year, Onslow Memorial treats close to 600 patients. While the hospital isn't using the stent-light clot-removing devices, they are administering a drug called TPA, or tissue plasminogen activator, which breaks down blood clots. Josephine Malfitano is the Performance Improvement and Accreditation Manager at Onslow Memorial.
TPA drug is very effective. Matter of fact, we had two patients back-to-back in this past week, and both of those folks will have either minimal or no long-term rehabilitation.
Program Director with the North Carolina Stroke Association, Margaret Rodasil, agrees, saying TPA is more readily available than other stroke treatments.
And even rural hospitals, you don't have to go to a huge medical center to do that, can have the capability to administer that drug, and it is a miracle.
Rodasil, who also serves as the stroke coordinator at Stanley Regional Medical Center in Albemarle, North Carolina, says the chances of someone surviving a stroke and decreasing the amount of time spent rehabilitating goes up significantly if they receive the TPA drug within 4.5 hours of the stroke.
Time is brain. That's our mantra. If they sit and wait till tomorrow to see if they're going to get better, it's too late. We just had one this week that got here in the time frame. They were totally paralyzed on one side and could not speak. We gave the medicine, and the person is walking out of our hospital today, 2 days later, after experiencing that huge stroke.
Onslow Memorial Hospital is unable to provide the Solitaire Flow Restoration Device, or Trevo device, because they don't have a neurosurgery department. Performance Improvement and Accreditation Manager Josephine Malfitano says if a patient needs this procedure, they are transferred to Vidant Health, which is about 60 miles away. Onslow Memorial provides rehabilitation services for stroke patients and patient therapy supervisor Doug Combs.
In terms of physical therapy, we usually assist with walking and balance retraining as well as general strengthening, particularly on the patient's affected side. In terms of occupational therapy, they assist with retraining of ADLs, the activities of daily living, such as dressing, bathing, eating, and cooking. And then speech therapists are involved, usually with helping with swallowing and or speaking or mental processing issues.
Stroke is the leading cause of serious long-term disabilities, and there's currently no drug treatment for post-stroke rehabilitation. According to Science Daily Research News, a new study from Creighton University School of Medicine, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, found that Brevetoxin II, a compound found in marine algae, can stimulate nerve cell growth and plasticity in cultured mouse neurons. Director of Marine Science at UNC Wilmington, Daniel Baden, says the compound is commonly referred to as red tide.
The Brevetoxin II in specific, are natural products that are produced by the Florida red tide dinoflagellate Karenia brevis. They occur on the west coast of Florida, Gulf of Mexico, through to Texas, and form blooms known as red tides.
The Marine Biotechnology and North Carolina facility at UNCW cultures more than 1,000 ocean organisms for biomedical research, including brevetoxin. Baden says the algae could be used to develop a drug for people recovering from stroke.
And that's really what this is all about. It's taking the molecules, whatever the molecule is, in whatever organism we have, whatever one we're studying, and look at how does it act on a molecular level. And then say, what disease states do we know that these molecules could be applied to that would presumably reverse the effect in the disease state on a molecular level by treatment with these molecules?
Baden says they have many more tests to run, and a drug for stroke victims is still about 10 years away. While eastern North Carolina remains the place where the highest number of stroke deaths occur, it's also where the latest treatments and technology is being used to help stroke patients and where groundbreaking discoveries are taking place. Still, experts say the best way to safeguard yourself against having a stroke altogether is by eating healthy foods, getting plenty of exercise, and not smoking. Jared Brumbaugh, Public Radio East.
It was a 1980 Ford Fiesta.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It used to belong to Bruce Willis's brother. It was a terrible car. The door would fall off and you'd have to pick it up and put it back in the car and latch it. Oil would ooze out of the dashboard. It's amazing to think that even that car could become like a segment in All Things Considered or a Bluff the Listener game. Turn your car into the programs you love.
For more information on the vehicle donation program, visit publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's getting to be time to really focus on your vegetable garden for this year. And I know a lot of people say, it costs so much to grow your own vegetables, it's not worth it. But you know what? Vegetable gardening does not have to be terribly expensive. So here's my thoughts on how you can reduce the cost of vegetable gardening. First of all, As we know, you get a more efficient yield if you plant in a bed. That is, a patch of soil about 3 feet wide and as long as you want that's filled with vegetables, rather than just a single row of vegetables and then a big wide path. Now, a lot of folks feel that to have a bedded garden with these wide rows, you have to buy wood and build beds. But that's not true. You can make a raised bed garden, although the beds won't be terribly high, but they will be raised and they will be bedded, simply by digging out the area that you want to garden in and forming the beds with the soil. Try hard to get them flat on the top and just gently sloping at the edge. If you make them a mound high in the middle and running all the way down to the edges, you'll lose a lot of water and have trouble growing your vegetables. So build up your bed by adding organic matter and by shoveling your paths down lower and throwing that over onto the bed area, and have a bedded garden without the expense of buying wood or cinder block to outline the beds. Now, I just mentioned organic matter. You can go the expensive route and buy bag after bag of rotted compost or one of the manure products, or you can make your own compost pile for free. That's simply a matter of mixing your scraps of vegetables and fruits with leaves from your yard, although leave out the live oak leaves and magnolia leaves, and the pine straw. They just don't break down quickly enough. Mixing those with plenty of moisture, maybe even a tiny bit of fertilizer to get it started, stirring it every few days and letting it heat up and decompose on its own. You'll have beautiful compost before you know it, and you can use that to enhance your bed. You don't have to buy the expensive stuff. The next way to cut down costs for your garden? Buy seeds rather than plants for those items that grow well from seed, and so many do. If you're growing beans or cucumbers or squash or pretty much anything really, you can grow it in the garden from seed. And you can buy a packet of seed, often with dozens of seeds, for about a dollar or two. And they go a long way. So don't feel like you have to transplant plants into your garden for everything you grow. Consider using seed for many of your key plants. And save your investment of plants for things that you might want to try two or three varieties, such as tomatoes, and pick just the plants you want. The next way to save money, go for high yields in small spaces. Think about plants like bush beans that produce so many beans in a small space, or even climbing beans that you put up on a teepee. Beans are great producers. Squash as well. If you can protect it from the squash bugs and the vine borers, you can get a big yield in a small area from squash. Compared to that, corn, well, it's wonderful, but you really get a small yield out of a big space, so it might not be the most cost-efficient way to grow a garden. To save money, you can also plan on freezing, canning, or drying the excess vegetables. Let's say you plant a block of beans in the garden. Particularly if you use bush beans, they're going to all be ripe at about the same time, and you can't eat them all at once. Think about blanching them first. You can't freeze vegetables without blanching them first, or they really won't be any good when you eat them later. And then just freezing them in freezer bags. You can can if you already have some jars, or find somebody trying to give jars away, or just make a one-time investment in canning jars that you use over and over. But keeping the vegetables when they're at their freshest and best by some means of preservation, rather than throwing away excess, well, that's going to make your garden much more cost efficient as well. So you can grow a garden, and you can do it at a very low price if you follow just these few tips. Also, the most important thing, start with a small garden. A family of two or three can grow quite a bit of produce in two beds, 4 foot by 8 foot. Think of starting small. Keep your costs down as well as your labor, and make sure it's something you love doing because it's not overwhelming. Go out there and start a cost-efficient garden this spring, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry of the Garden Journal.
Easter is this weekend. Lots of people are preparing what they're going to eat on Sunday. Here's an authentic Southern recipe that you may never have heard of. Food writer and restaurant critic Eddie Browning joins us with his Inner Banks recipe for ham dumplings.
The classic, the historical ham dumplings.
As I understand it, this is a recipe that was passed down to you that dates back to the late 18th century, but you've also made some changes to it along the way.
The one that I'm giving you is not as hard as your grandparents or great-grandparents did. It's a little easier.
All right, well, let's get started. What's the first step?
The first choice of ham in this dish is a dry-cured old or country ham, but it's even respectable made with a brine-cured baked ham, just so long as it hasn't been impregnated with artificial smoke flavoring.
Of course, you want to get that natural smoky flavor. But instead of using a country ham, which is going to add a lot of salt to this dish, if you're trying to watch your salt intake, what other ham would you suggest using that would give you just as much flavor?
I would still go with the dry cured ham or the country ham, and I would soak it out, the salt out.
Okay, so the first step in this recipe is to start gathering the ingredients to make our stock.
But to start off, take the bone from the country ham, or 3 pounds of ham hock or knuckle, and put it in a large stock pot, and then pour 3 quarts of cold water over it.
Now, I guess if you wanted to add an extra layer of flavor, you could add a little bit of chicken stock instead of just straight water.
Oh, yes. Now, this is important. Turn on the heat as low as you can get it, and bring the water slowly to the boiling point, and then through this whole time, carefully skim off the scum as it pops to the surface. Now, this process should take about 45 minutes.
Now, see, it's time to add your vegetables to the pot. That includes 1 white onion peeled and halved, also a large carrot peeled and cut into large chunks. You also want to go ahead and add the spices at this time, which include a bay leaf, thyme, parsley, and 6 whole peppercorns. Eddie, how long do you let that boil?
Slowly simmer for at least 1 hour. 2 hours is much better. Then strain, discarding the solids. Return the broth to the pot. Bring it back to a boil and reduce it to 1.5 quarts. You're actually reducing it about a half.
All right, so now that we have the stock made, the next step, I guess, is to make the dumplings, right?
Oh, yes. There are 2 kinds of dumplings. One is the flat dumplings, and one is the what I call drop dumplings, raised dumplings. The directions for making both of those kinds are on the website and very easy to follow.
You know how Easter can get. You get pressed for time, you have company coming over, and you just simply don't have time to make these dumplings. Is the store-bought dumplings okay to use in this recipe?
I sure would in a pinch. I'd use them, but they're not as good as the homemade.
Well, is it something you can make ahead of time?
You can do up the flat dumplings and freeze them at the stadium, and then bring them out, let them thaw out, and then cut and cook. Anyway, after the dumplings cook and they're done, they should be done in 5 minutes. Then stir in 1 cup of the raw or leftover country ham that you cut into julienne strips, add that to the pot and the parsley, and simmer for 2 to 3 minutes more. Then ladle the ham and the dumplings into a serving plate or individual soup plates, and sprinkle them with parsley and serve it once.
That sounds really good. What's something that you would serve along with this dish?
I like crusty bread. Man, I'll tell you, you got another good... Your whole family will be smacking and saying how good it is.
Well, Eddie Browning, thank you so much for taking some time to share some of your recipes with us.
Jared, you and your family, as well as all your listeners, have a good Easter weekend.
We've posted the recipe for ham dumplings on our website, publicradioeast.org. You'll also find a traditional Easter breakfast recipe for hot cross buns and a delicious side dish, spring onions and cream. The Downey's Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Crystal Coast Civic Center, Moorhead City, where every event is waterfront, business meeting, and special event facilities available. Crystal Coast Civic Center, online at crystalcoastcivicctr.com.
Is the weekday commute getting to you?
I'm driving right now as I'm online. Propane tanker.
The office getting a little crazy?
I'm impressed, Miss Harrison. I never saw anybody hit an author before.
Well, just a little move we learned in biblio-taekwondo.
On the job perks getting smaller?
My very own three-hole punch!
Oh, no. Escape from it all this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evenings at 6 on TRE Public Radio East.
This is the Downey's Journal. Joan Karas is the author of nearly 20 children's books, her first published book back in 1980. In 3 decades, there's been many changes. Books once written on electric typewriters with lots of correction tape and sent to publishers in weighty boxes via the U.S. Postal Service are now produced on computers with spell check and whisked off as PDF files to publishers with a single keystroke. But that's not all that's changed in 30 years' time. The language itself has been updated. Joan Karas explains.
Every aspect of language intrigues me. Writing, reading, speaking, creative cursing, all of it. Experts don't know where or when language first began, but they do know that all human societies on record have possessed language. Words are the building blocks of language, and they appear seemingly out of nowhere, while others become outdated and are rarely used. Frequency of use is the key. When new words become dependable regulars, major dictionaries include them. Then we think of them as real words, no matter how strange they may have sounded at first. Some words move into the dictionary because, after they're here, it seems as if they should have been here all along. They combine roots or syllables that we know well. Consider the words chillax, frenemy, and megachurch, which have just been added to the official list of words in the English language. Chillax, from chill out and relax, is a logical offspring of its parents. Your friend who often argues with you is your frenemy, of course. And megachurch seems like a no-brainer, doesn't it? My favorite in this category is a word formed from the prefix auto and the adverb magically, giving us automagically, to describe anything that happens automatically in a way that seems magical. Inventions like the computer spawn entirely new terms, blog, website, and Google, for instance. Old familiar words, such as up and down, server and browser, acquire additional brand new meanings. That's fine, but I think they should not have messed with the word mouse. A mouse is a small, furry rodent with an inquisitive nose, 2 ears, and a tail. A personal live mouse is a great pet. The really startling new words are the most fun. When you first hear them, you say, huh? For example, the new adjective bargainous describes a purchase that was less costly than you had expected. I would like to, but have never been able, to term a medical prescription bargainous. If you describe a situation in highly lurid terms, making it seem far worse than it actually is, you are catastrophizing. As an example, once upon a time, our younger daughter tore out of the family room and into the kitchen, hollering, "He's always picking on us! You have to stop him right now!" The he was our only son, 3 years old at the time. When I went into the family room to investigate, I found him sitting across the room from his older 9-year-old sister. The 6-year-old, the one who had come for help, cried, "See? He keeps stabbing us with those tinker toys." I didn't understand until he held up a long, wobbly stick. "It's a long-range botherer," he said proudly. "I made it all by myself." He poked the 9-year-old, who cried, "Mom!" This entire skirmish, I now see, was catastrophized, just like most children's squabbles. What a wonderful new word, and what fun it is to look forward to more of them. I truly heart words.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.
This is The Sound.
5 hours of Americana. Half of what we know comes true. Roots rock. And contemporary folk.
This is The Sound.
Weekday evening, 7 to 12 midnight on PRE, Public Radio East, News and Ideas at 88.5, 90.3, 91.5, and 88.1.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features that you'd like to hear on the Downeast Journal, you can submit them at publicradioeast.org.